destroying the entire universe.
Welcome to Radio Free Deimos, an Ixun Draconis podcast transmitting from ASAF Hall at Lake Voltaire on Deimos. Deimos. Easy access to three major space lanes and a Starbucks. This is Season 1, Episode 1, Bucket of Opinions. First, let's take a second to meet our lovely hosts, Ashtar, Wines, and I'm Corbeau. Nixon is somewhere outside the airlock. I think he'll be here next time if there's a next time for him. We'll find out. So, someone, throw out your name and a bit of your gaming history.
Well, I'm Wines. My background is mostly in war games, stuff like Warhammer 40K. Yeah, I've come to RPGs from that. So I kind of have an emphasis on rules mechanics and combat and playing very boring characters because I'm a practical type person. We've been playing D&D 4th Edition for a couple of years now, and so we're starting to branch out into different things. Recently, in Ashtar's campaign, we were trying out Fate rules. That was a lot of fun. And just recently, we started dabbling in HSD, and I'm kind of interested to see how this goes.
I'm curious about the idea of a practical gamer. Maybe we can unpack that later on.
Sure.
My name's Ashtar, and I'm kind of got my start in 2nd edition, running games for my brothers in the backseat of long car trips. From there, it kind of blossomed into more modern games, both on the video game side and the pen and paper side. I've alternately been playing or running various D&D games for the past couple of years, mostly with the same group, and came back around to my turn to run the game and flipped up to HSDs, who are kind of giving the rule set a shake and seeing what falls out.
And I'm Corbeau. I've been gaming since 1986 now, so 30 years. Mostly Dungeons & Dragons, but I played with rules-crunchy systems like GURPS, one of my favorites, and spent a good 10 years as a LARPer. For now, though, we're looking at HSD. We found it on Kickstarter, and it's got some great ideas, and happy to run with it. A chance to write up some really strange new characters. So, here's tonight's framework. We've got some Ixun Draconis, I'm just going to say HSD news, which would be the Kickstarter. So we'll start there. So the Kickstarter. This is Pierce Fraser's third Kickstarter. It runs through July 10th, and the last time I checked, it was over the hump at 66% of its goal of $10,000. Any thoughts?
I mean, I've read through the Kickstarter. It definitely has some interesting ideas. The concept of not just selling characters, but selling modular pieces that can be put together to kind of assemble more of a custom character. Mm-hmm. Definitely fits a lot more, especially for HSD, where you're making characters that are probably not being supported by other miniature manufacturers out there.
And also in canon, having them built out of parts.
That is true.
So yeah, I've been looking at the Kickstarter myself. It's 3D printed plastic miniatures. They're built out of a series of component parts and can be assembled through a viewing program. They call it the visor. And you can't see me gesturing with my hands right now, but I'm sketching something out in the air. They're starting with the core races from the first rule book. And also, by extension, they're adding hyenas and raccoons. So some people will be happy about that.
Yay.
The Doberman, the main 3D model, looks really cute. The details are pretty sharp on them. Ashtar's nodding. You can't see that as well.
3D printing is definitely starting to come into its own, so it's good to see it's going to practical applications.
Totally, totally practical gaming. This is a new term for me.
I'd like to create the rumor that they're talking about using Lego technology to make the actual parts interchangeable, but this is not actually true.
Oh, we'll ask Pierce about that, actually. Lego compatibility might be a stretch goal at $40,000. So we've got, $10,000 is going to be the first goal. That's the core races, hyenas, et cetera, et cetera. Extended races at $15,000. $20,000, you start getting fancy clothes, which fits most gaming economies. And then the cogs, I think, are at $30,000. They start adding the oddball things later on. I don't know when we'll get our brain-devouring brain bugs, but maybe later. I like the way they're prioritized because you've got the core races up front, weirdness later on. But as an option, I know cogs have a lot of fans out there, but it's a good stretch goal. There is a video, if you're following the updates on the campaign, there's a new video of Pierce playing around with some of the painted minis. And again, they do look really sharp, kind of Celtic designs on the Tar character. My main concern with the Kickstarter is that the price tag of $60 for the lower level minis is a little bit steep, and you're really paying to support the creator and the creator's vision at that point. A lot of people in the Kickstarter world understand that economy, and that's great. The project is 2/3 of goal. It's really great progress for something that's not even halfway to its final date yet. So it looks great. I look forward to seeing what happens next. And overall, I think the Kickstarter is doing quite well.
I will say, as a miniature gamer, while $60 is not pocket change, it's not that much in the context of miniatures. A lot of Games Workshop figures go past the $60 mark for the bigger ones, but it's high. It's certainly not ridiculous.
And these are kind of customized too, which is going to add to the cash value of them.
Right.
The Kickstarter is on Kickstarter.com. Search for HSD, search for Anthro Miniatures, and we will have a link to it in our show notes once we post this. Part 2, we have some questions with thanks to Jinx Curry on our Telegram group and Dulcia from our Sunday night game talking about great white sharks and snow leopards, henceforth snepards. Dulcia threw this out during character creation, and they're kind of related concepts. Jinx's question was whether he could make or how to make a great white shark character. Well, why is that a problem?
Well, that is one of the ones that is specifically mentioned in the rules as not part of the vector program. So while they were looking at sharks, within the expanded rule set, the great white was passed over in favor of some of the other sharks that were less suited to hunting and killing prey, essentially.
So the vector line developers had seen Jaws a few times then?
You might say that.
Okay. The snepards are not specifically banderblocked in canon. They're just not part of the main list of species, which I think for felines is something along the general lines of cats, tigers, lions, cheetahs, something, something, something.
And house cats.
And house cats. Cats and cats. Talking Jinx Curie's question over in Telegram, we had some suggestions and some ideas. Jinx himself suggested going with a blip, which is a logical choice for any newly designed, fresh off the printing press character. He also suggested going with some sort of mecha shark or android shark, which sounds cinematically quite awesome. I would want it to be at least 30 feet tall, bare minimum. I think we kind of ignored and didn't discuss the mecha shark or android option. We also don't allow cogs in our campaigns, so that might be part of that. I suggested going with a generic shark and just kind of ignoring the lore. And I think ignore the lore is going to be one of my new slogans going forward. And Ashtar, I think you were much more pro-blip than I am.
I'm a little bit more pro-blip in that when you start looking at what creates a blip, there's two different ways to look at it. You can certainly look at the blip covers, the wild, the exotic, the things that are just not covered in the rules. But at the same time, creating a blip is also using just the vector program itself to make a new production line of critter. So you can take this to the extreme and have your glitter dragons that burst into fire and run whatever you want, but you can dial a blip back to simply fill in some of the gaps in the vector program already. So it really depends on how you want to interpret the blip, which was the argument that I was bringing forth for a blip.
Now I'm going to say that the rules as written on page extended 50, citing chapter and verse here, the first generic species choice in each family is purposely vague and contain dozens of options that can exist, but just aren't that common. If you could use a generic race, a sparrow or a lynx, you're best off using that generic species. Blips are the odd man out and a major character trait.
That is true.
Those are the rules, sir.
Those are the rules as written.
Yes.
But we can also look at the intent behind.
No.
If you take cats, for example, many of the cats... The cats is probably the weaker of the two to support a blip methodology, in that a snow leopard potentially could be already within the vector code. It was just not one of the main lines that they've run out. Now, a snow leopard is a little bit more deeper change than just a house cat with a spotty tail. But the argument exists that you can certainly have a base cat that is a snow leopard or a base cat that is just a mutation, not really a mutation, but a flicker in the gene code that is coming back forth and still falling under the feline family. And at that point, while the rules support this, you then have to ask what is more cinematically appropriate or what is more appropriate for the character. If you want your character to be a feline and someone that passes without a second glance among most vectors because they're obviously a cat just with some odd coloration, then running a snow leopard through the standard feline build tree works perfectly fine. But if you want to be, let's say, a little bit more exotic in your backstory, and perhaps you're running through a limited edition run of vectors that was created by a corporation either for a specific purpose or a test run, then at that point you definitely could be making a argument for something that's a little bit more unique. And that is exactly where the blip comes in to describe, yes, but. Yes, I am a cat.
Well, one question I have, I haven't read the rules that closely. Is there a definitive list of exactly what species exist and what species don't? Or is it, I mean, it sounds like just here or there that they've mentioned here and that like owls are a special case. It sounds like great white sharks are a special case, but I assume there's no mention of snow leopards one way or the other. Am I right?
To rewind just a little bit on this, if you look at the list of families in the book, each one of them has five lines under them, or the avia have four. With the birds, it's going to be something like raptors, chickens, red-breasted thrushes. And then the top line is bird, just bird. So if you want to play something that's not a chicken or not a raptor or not a red-breasted thrush, go with bird. That's what where you're going to find your pigeons, for those of us that really crave the experience of playing a vectored pigeon.
Sure.
So, the list of families is pretty defined, but the species is it's a little more open-ended.
It is a little bit more open-ended. At the same time, the vectorization process, as it were, the actual genetic programming to build a vector is open source is not quite the right term, but it's a very well-known process. You can cook up a new vector or a new species with the appropriate lab. It's frankly, in this world, it's not very expensive and it doesn't take a massive amount of knowledge. The reason that most people don't do that is because you're then somewhat responsible for the new child. But if you look at it in that respect, then if you're the fact that you're a family feline and you are a cat is simply that you were in one of the first generations. You were within the subset that was programmed into cats. If you are not actually part of the first generation of cats, or if you're something that just hasn't appeared yet, you can make the argument either way. If you have a mad scientist that goes out and creates a breed of cat that no one has seen before, but still follows all the rules for the family feline vectors, the argument then is, well, are you a new creation or are you just a new wrinkle on the original feline? And I think that's an argument that can be easily made either way.
Well, I think also one point you made in one of the first sessions you ran of this is that people creating their own intelligent life, doing custom jobs like that, would probably not be that odd. I mean, in our world, we're used to that being kind of a Frankenstein thing, but in this world where everyone is a fairly recent creation, it wouldn't be that unusual, which is worth thinking about.
We have a lateral dog stuck in the back room. It's my uncle.
Even the laterals want to get their 2 cents in.
What did you say, Wines?
I don't know. Just noting that custom genetically engineered intelligent things would not be that unusual. In fact, that might be a question. Is the question not why did you do it? Well, it's not what did you do. It's just why did you do it? So someone makes a blip. The first question is just like, oh, what was their motivation? It's like, okay, you have laser eyes and horns. That's whatever. But why'd they do that? What was the motivation? Who's getting paid for this?
Okay, so my concern would be to avoid the kind of the beautiful and unique snowflake effect, which is super common with blips, because as you said, radiant pink sparkle dragons, DIY, and a blip is 2 in a million, not 1 in a million, but 2 in a million. So very high, beautiful snowflake potential there. But you're saying go with what makes sense with the character. Wines was talking about how this is a world with lots of genetic augmentation. We've got crazy superstars that are massively larger than life, and an entire culture that's built on the concept that genetic manipulation is pretty cool. It's why we're all here.
Well, maybe not maybe cool, but it's just that people are totally used to it. It's not unusual. It's not even quite uninteresting after a few centuries. It's like, it's old hat.
The status quo.
If technically what you create is amazing, like, I've never seen a transparent fish before. That might be one thing. Or if you have really bizarre reasons to, or really good reasons to, like, wow, this company invented mice and now they've made a million. What an interesting story. But the fact that they just did it by itself, created a new vector, is not in itself that interesting.
Okay.
It actually could be a good point that was the first mouse a blip or not?
The first mouse was a slave species, sir, and it's very insensitive of you to forget that.
Not quite my point. My point would more be that what we're really calling a blip is going to be a one-off character. If you create 12 of them, are they still a blip? If you create an entire generation or an entire product line of them, are they still a blip?
Now that's a new generation at that point.
That's a new generation of vectors, a new family, as it were. So, again, this falls back to where does it make more sense in the story? Is the character falling under a family designation? Are they falling more under a blip designation? Because the blip does have a couple of game effects that could come into play. Most notably that the dice that you're assigning is more stringently structured as to how you build your character.
Yeah, blips aren't very good at parties.
Blips are amazing at parties. They're just not very good, you know, socially at parties. But as the centerpiece?
Fair enough. Stepping away from the mechanics of it, we did have some suggestions on how to kind of bring a great white shark into play. A couple of stories that might make fun backgrounds. All these are kind of dependent on how flexible your game master is and how rough and ready they are with the rules. Some game masters are very much rules as written, and some are completely loose with the party. Although I would hope that HSD would lend itself to much more freewheeling game masters. It's a fairly rules-light system and very flexible.
I'd see whether if they call out great white sharks as in specifically saying they didn't do it, that sounds like plot point.
Yeah.
Which a GM might look at that and say, I'm not interested in that plot point. I'm never going to do it. So sure, play one. I don't care.
That's an interesting distinction because I would call out the owls as more of a plot point at that point because the owls are not, oh, we just didn't do this. It's we did this. Things went wrong and no one is ever going to do this again. Whereas the Great White was more of a very rare glimmer of vectors going, you know what? We could do that, but it doesn't seem like a very good idea. Let's do this instead. Which really opens the door to someone else following up, oh, 50 years down the road, going, why this not? Seems cool. Let's do it. Which, in my view of HSD, especially socially, culturally, that really is enough of a reason to do a great many stupid things.
Yeah, that gee whiz factor is really high. So we did have some thoughts on how to bring in a great white shark. My first one was that Makos, which is an existing species, are very close relatives to the great white. They're the next closest ones. So a fluke, a mutation of the Mako shark would be a really good choice. Yeah, they're not laughing at me. There are some things that have not been controlled for in vector DNA. In particular, no one knows where bioluminescence comes from. That's one of the, you know, 1 in 10,000 morphisms. However, look up, or don't look up, Ninja Lantern Shark. I will put a link to a Ninja Lantern Shark in the show notes. They are really horrible, and they glow in the dark. Bioluminescence is not that uncommon in sharks. So, yeah, there are some things they haven't controlled for, no matter how much they say they perfected and eliminated all redundancies in the genetic code of vectors.
I've heard rumors it's due to mothers nibbling on glow sticks during pregnancy.
Or being scared by them. It's a Lamarckian evolution. We also talked a bit about Progenitus tinkering with Mako vectors to create some more durable sharks to infiltrate the Transcendent technology base on Europa. Progenitus is the medical corp. TTI is the weird science corp. They are not friends. And perhaps Progenitus took the shark line back one step towards Megalodon to make something a little bit better as a combat soldier. Not out of the question, there's a lot of shadow ops in this game system.
Another question, especially if you want to get a little bit more philosophical about it, is if you make a shark that looks more like a great white and acts more like a great white, but you don't actually have any of the genes of the great white shark because those were lost 700 years ago, is it a great white or is it just someone that looks like one?
I like that kind of dodge. That works really well. looks like great white is on your character sheet description. The simplest way of solving this problem is to ignore it entirely and not tell the game master. No one reads the descriptions anyway.
I also think if a game master said you can play any kind of dog you want, but not Chihuahuas, and if the importance of the Chihuahua race being different did not come up in the game, I would feel cheated.
That's true. I will note, though, that the player that requested the snow leopard very specifically said, yeah, I don't want to be a reskinned cat. So sometimes that just doesn't work as just filling out the description on the character sheet.
So there's not one way to reskin a cat? Sorry.
I noticed that the races in HSD don't have a lot to them. I mean, nothing says that your chickadee character can't have a body stat much higher than the person who plays an elephant character. It's just a handful of little things you bolt on. So honestly, there's not a lot to the races. I mean, you can do stupid things. You can have a tiny elephant or a huge chickadee, but you shouldn't because it's dumb.
If you're aiming for the effect of playing a great white character, you could play just a very large murder shark. Use the macro advantage or some portion thereof or the enhanced bite, and you're halfway there already.
Is a shark that doesn't act like a murder shark actually a shark?
Maybe it's a nurse shark. I think one last idea we had was suggesting that the Transcendent technology weird tech is sending species down some sort of alternate evolutionary path. This was suggesting like a major plot arc to the game master. Sometimes they'll go with that, sometimes they won't. But Transcendent technology is really weird stuff, and TTI's home base is a water world, so I see this as being a really strong cross point. You start creating some sort of fourth generation of strangely retro vectors, and then the game master goes plays riffs for a while because that's really what he was doing in his heart.
Either that or we start playing around with Jurassic Park as a new source material.
Well, one question I would have, and I don't think there's an answer to this, is how rigid one wants to be with the species definitions. Because, for example, dogs is one category. Obviously, there's a huge difference between a Chihuahua and a Great Dane. Is it reasonable for someone to say, I want to play a Great Dane, I would like to use the wolf package? From a fairness perspective, in my mind, that's fine. I mean, as long as you're using a existing package, if you want to reskin it, you're not cheating anyone. But I don't know, some game masters might want to say, no, you can only use the wolf package if you're a wolf, period. Others might say, no, that describes a Great Dane better than dog does.
On the one hand, I agree with you, and we've had some pretty strong characters that have made by swapping race out and not necessarily telling the game master, who I don't think is listening to this podcast. And I really did love my Null that was actually a shifter. On the other hand, with so little to differentiate the races, I'm not sure that swapping out whatever the wolf skill isn't cheapening the wolf somehow. Although there's very minor differences, there's not that much there to begin with. So if you're swapping out the one thing, that might lose some identity if you don't replace it somewhere later on.
Sure.
Because there's not that much there to begin with.
True. I mean,
what would a black bear be without one point in science?
Well, they now have available the reclamation surgeries, which do actually make a rather large difference.
True. And those can be used with a permissive game master to flesh out a beginning level character as well.
Although the game also allows for that, if I'm not mistaken, there's some option which lets you take any other species reclamation. So it's not that hard to get anything else if you work at it.
yeah, that's one of the morphisms. That's how that, how did that get there? Or
half-breed.
Half-breed, no, hybrid, yeah.
Hybrid.
No, actually, I think there's a, no, I'm thinking surgeries. Never mind, ignore me.
Okay.
At the same time, a vector is a vector is a vector. All the gene code is out there and open for anyone to flip through.
If I'm not mistaken, when a daddy otter loves a mommy serval very much, the kids might have a little bit of serval in them at the... Ooh, don't like how that's going. The kids might be having some traits from both parents at the end, even not... If not a true hybrid, then, you know, some aspects of mommy, some aspects of daddy. So, again, yeah, the code's flexible. What a character looks like is based on its design and intent almost as much as the rules is written.
A lot of that is also up to the setting interpretation. The Mutt protocol or the Mutt program that keeps half-breeds from happening, it really can become a plot point whether you want to push, whether the storyteller wants to push that as very aggressively and keep true to the families, or wants to open that a little bit and start introducing more of an acceptable hybrid scenario.
I kind of like to have an episode down the road on childhood, which would kind of include some of the Mutt protocol stuff and
the Easter Bunny scenario?
The birds and the bees. Oh, there are no bees. Yeah, there are no bee vectors, so we can't have that conversation.
Those were the brain-eating insects that you referenced earlier.
Oh, the brain bugs. Do we want to skip to the actual topic then? Once we've got to brain bugs, because that's one of my favorite things.
Sure.
Okay. Tonight's topic is going to be kind of informal, an introduction to Ik Sunt Draconis, and why we think it's worth talking about. So it might be worth opening it up with just kind of a short description of the game for new listeners, people that don't have the book, that sort of thing. In my episode zero post slash podcast, I described it as being a transhuman, posthuman, unapologetically furry science fiction game with an interplanetary scope. I think that about sums it up. Would you add to that?
Could you put the initial I before it? That's it.
Oh, sure. That would be an ITPFSAFAIS, which is unpronounceable in this language. great. So first off, transhuman, that's the idea of we've evolved past a lot of our problems. Technology can solve a lot of difficulties in day-to-day life. It's a fairly optimistic genre, is that fair to say? Nod. I kind of feel, in many ways, like Roddenberry's original version of Star Trek comes close to that, but they haven't transcended human limitations so much. There's still disease and things like that. Post-human is, well, in this game, it's 700 years after the death of the last human being, and I believe that's a major plot point. So far as furry goes, this game is very pro-furry. It's not just anthro-animals, but there's... tiny anthro-animals, tiny non-anthro-animals, animals with wings, giant animal people.
Tars.
Digitigrades and plantigrades, so you have all options and hooves.
And sparkle dogs.
Yeah, actually, one of my characters is a glowing squirrel. So I think we cover most anything you'd see on your average furry art site as long as it's, you know, wearing a jumpsuit.
Yeah, I think the only thing it misses... is that this amuses me to no end, that while fangs or horns or hooves, these minor things, have a game effect, gender does not have any game effect yet. Maybe that's going to be an expansion. But in terms of incorporating almost anything that someone might have in their fursona, I think that's the only thing they're missing, is having gender have a game effect.
Well, at some point, I would like to discuss the sci-fi setting for the FAPP role-playing game, but that's going to be another episode.
Okay.
The game is interplanetary in its scale, so it ranges from really Venus to Jupiter, possibly Saturn, but not significantly beyond that. So it's near solar system, things you can see with your unaided eye to the most part.
It really sticks to within the habitat zone of the solar system. And even with 700 years under their belt, interstellar and faster than light travel just does not exist. So it limits the scope in that sense.
And I think that's a neat idea. I think it's very tempting to just jump straight to interstellar travel once you're doing a sci-fi game, but the scope of that becomes amazingly huge. You know, honestly, our solar system is a pretty big place. I think there's a lot of places you can go with that, and it's not all just totally made up, because, I mean, as you say, this is stuff that we can observe, that we know something about. I mean, obviously you'll be making up more for the RPG, but we all have a passing familiarity with the solar system. And so I think it's a very neat place to set a game.
Philosophically, the game is about what it means to be human in a post-human world, in a world which doesn't have the gender assumptions we have, the kind of the legacy of racism and war that we as 20th century humans have. So if you go beyond that, past Jupiter, past Saturn, you may be losing track of that kind of baseline of what humanity actually is.
It is definitely one of the taglines to the system, although exploring some of those ideas does depend on whether or not your players are murder hobos or not.
Murder hobos, yes. We have a starship now, so we can live in the starship and can't actually technically be hobos. I've asked our distinguished hosts to do some homework and bring a couple of points they think make the game particularly worth talking about, worth playing. Someone start.
A hard thing about playing a civilized game is that we, the players, aren't from that civilization. I mean, and if it's based on something, on a movie like The Matrix or Blade Runner, something like that, at least we have that as a reference. If it's a totally made-up setting, the problem is we just don't have a lot of connection with that setting, and I feel it's hard to play an intelligent, civilized member of society when I just don't know that much about the society. But I think that the game's broad enough in that there's enough places that you can be from. You can be from space stations, you can be from moons of Mars or Jupiter, I think, or you can be from planets like Venus or Mars, that there could be lots of different cultures. And so it can help cover up any player ignorance as just saying, oh, I'm not from this place, and so that's why this surprises me. That's why my expectations are a little bit off. It also allows for a bit more variety in terms of player concept. In a world like Shadowrun, which is like dark and gritty, certain character concepts just won't work. Whereas in this game, you might have places that are very dark and gritty, or you might have places, your character may have come from a communal space station where everything is very idyllic, and now they're being shocked that the rest of the solar system is not like that. That gives you lots of opportunities for diverse backgrounds.
It really hits the sweet spot of a lot of sci-fi, and that is one of the things that really attracted my interest. There are places where it hits the utopia. There are places where it hits the dystopia. But for the most part, it's neither. There are places within the rules, within the setting, where you start touching on some hard sci-fi concepts. There's also some where it really approaches more of a fantasy sci-fi. But on the whole, again, kind of sweet spot, kind of more centered to both of them. Even within a quote-unquote limited world, because you're really limited just to a couple of planets and a couple of moons, space stations, the rule set, the setting, provides a lot of opportunity to mix in a lot of different concepts, a lot of different character ideas, and a lot of different stories in a believable fashion, in a fashion that doesn't necessarily break suspension of disbelief and doesn't necessarily bring in dimensional hopping foreigners from another place that you don't really have a good reason to be here.
But at the same time, it's a game that has limits. There's, like you said, a fairly short list of races, and even court backgrounds are fairly limited. And limits build characters. Right. Infinite resources, infinite ideas is very hard to build around, but having boundaries adds structure. I like that it's a rules light-ish game. I wouldn't call it a rules light game, but one thing that it embraces is the many roads lead to Jerusalem that you get with games like Fate, the really story over crunch games. Sometimes that can cause some problems in interpretation because you don't know whether to use kind of what flavor of the intimidation type skill to get to what end, or what specific stat do you use, because you have, you know, the ability to push with your mind stat, the ability to push with your physical stat, the ability to push with your social stat. You can even use your finances to make waves when E.F. Hutton talks, people listen. There's a lot of different approaches, and that is something I think is the hallmark of a lot of the 21st century games.
And I just want to interject on this point. I know this is going to be a discussion for a future cast, so I'm not going to hit it too hard, but one of the things that really attracted me was the whole concept of the stat grid. Mm-hmm. You have the five different stats, and they're separated between the four different columns. That gives you an entire matrix that you can choose from to adjust how you want to do something. You have the skills that kind of say, this is what I'm doing, but then you can choose your different options on, this is how I'm going to do it. Whether I'm going to just brute force my way through it, whether I'm going to kind of work my way around it, or I'm just going to depend on the force of who I am and what I am. That kind of flexibility, that kind of opportunity, lets you make so many more characters, so many more genre archetypes that don't get bogged down in the rules and don't get bogged down with a min-max concept of, well, this is all great, but I need a certain amount of constitution to keep my hit points up. That argument is just straight out the door.
So to flesh out what Ashtar just said, for a fairly light game that has 16 stats or so, but they're in nice little grids, there's mind, body, economy, and community are your master columns. Then the horizontal rows are more or less perceive, do, resist, and another one, which are eluding me at the moment. So while it is 16 stats or so, they're organized in a way that's fairly transparent. You can almost always decide whether you're going to be influencing a thing or resisting a thing or perceiving a thing or juggling a thing. The grid is easy to navigate, even if there are a lot of options.
A problem with D&D is that you have a whole bunch of people whose characters are different subtle variations on combat, and then you've got the one guy, the bard, who has his one magical stat that participates in a whole different game, which is making your bard roll and making miracles occur, while the rest of the party sits back and does nothing, which is not good. Fourth edition did better with some ideas for how the rest of the party could participate in social challenges, and that was an excellent idea. This game, in giving you a whole range of social stats, I think encourages you to think, well, it might be interesting if my character has a very powerful force of personality, and how could that impact how I can interact with people that I meet in the game, or that my character is very... I don't know how one would think of having a high social resistance. But no, I guess I can think of one.
I would counter that by saying that 4th Ed specifically made sure that nobody could be a social superstar and set everybody on the battle path. So that did kind of even the battlefield out, but maybe not in the best of ways.
Speaking as a survivor of the edition wars, every time you mention 4th Ed, we lose one third of our listeners, and we have three listeners right now. So worth pointing out, I love the system too, but so when you factor in the skills, you have this wide range of how can you apply your social push to technology or economics or combat somehow. So there's a lot of different ways to do any one single thing, which is exciting. I like that.
In the beginning, it can be overwhelming. There are a lot of options. There's a lot of different ways that you can approach a problem. And a lot of that really starts coming down to the storyteller and the player and the interaction between the two. Just to start throwing away a bunch of other choices and being very clear as to what the storyteller might accept, or from the player side, how can you create a story to guide towards or to make a case for the set that you actually want to push for.
One element of the setting I really love is that it's a consumer world. It's a consumer universe gone a little bit crazy. The generic corp Marsco controls... Well, it doesn't control, but it subtly influences everything. So your characters exist in a constant sea of subtle advertising, responding to the local corporation's product needs, demands, missions, requests, text messages, etc. It's a world driven entirely by corporation and commerce, with the other kind of three pillars of church and state just kind of shoved into the background.
or non-existent in some cases. It's also somewhat telling that vectors created artificial intelligence, and the first thing that they applied that to, in a certain sense, is to handle microtransactions and DLC payments.
What's a DLC payment? I don't know what that is.
And by that, I mean the entire concept of commercialization has evolved to the point where everyone who is born is assigned what's called a ledger. So you're essentially walking around with your own personal version of Wall Street, your own bank. And every time that you, say, sit on a bench, a payment is made against your ledger to the owner of that bench for wear and tear,
ding,
for usage fees.
Ding.
Use a door.
Ding.
You're paying both the people who made the hinge, the people who installed the door, and just the building itself, the landowner, a microtransaction to operate the door.
Ding.
Ding. And at the end of the day, this got so overwhelmingly... not financially expensive, just the overhead of handling all this got so much that that was all anyone was doing, was dealing with their microtransactions and payments. They just made an entire artificial intelligence that walked around with people and handled that for them.
And this takes us to murder hobos again, because now your character does not have to have a day job. You can just go on missions and your little background widget is going to maintain your social standing. You don't need a day job. You're free to move about the galaxy. No, solar system.
I'm just reminded, we're talking about the pervasive corporations and advertisements. I'm reminded of a short sci-fi story where corporate presence is so huge that everything, absolutely everything, is branded to the point that the person is sitting in a bathroom stall staring with horror at the fact that every single square of toilet paper has an advertisement printed on it. And I'm just imagining that each one of those is a contract, and that using it involves accepting the terms of the contract. There's kind of a reference to the futurists, I think, the group from the 30s that believed that technology would eventually bring us to a point where no one would have to work more than a few hours each day because technology would solve all of our problems for us. Well, this is a modernized version of that same concept.
I think in the story notes at the back of... the expanded version, they talk about the child lost in an undercity, and there's food on tap. So the basics of Maslow's lower level hierarchies are well taken care of by the corporate masters and literally their corporate teat.
Well, it becomes very much within their self-interest to do so. If you die, you are no longer a consumer, and you can no longer contribute your purchasing power to whatever you are working for. So it is definitely in their interest to keep people fed, watered, alive, and able to continue to generate wealth. There is, however, no real urgency to make that comfortable. So the food is probably going to be one of the most disgusting things that you are willing to eat and stay alive. Because wouldn't you rather buy this McBurger over here that tastes so much better?
Almost sounds like The Matrix, the energy storage unit scene.
Hmm. A similar thing that I'm reminded of, which is, it's irrelevant, but Larry Niven's universe, in which they decide to make all food and clothing can be free if you want, but everything free is laced with birth control. So you can live a completely free existence, but you'll never reproduce.
Okay, then.
I think that's our subject for episode 4. One thing I hit my head against when we were first discussing this game, and I think it may just be me, is I find HSD kind of claustrophobic. The title is Here There Be Dragons, which, if you go back to, you know, the old idea of an old map, that's the edge of the map, which beyond the edge, you don't know what's there. There's the scary unknown. But I feel like in HSD, there's spaces on the map that are circled with arrows pointing to them saying, Here There Be Dragons. And the universe is quite limited. I mean, we know that the moon is the subject of untold horror stories, and Earth is a very dangerous place, but we know where those dragons are. And I find the universe kind of limiting. For me, science fiction's heart is like the old Western movies, and where people are looking in the great frontier, they're going off to explore. But with the entire solar system kind of on camera, I don't know how much is actually unexplored.
Well, I think that, to me, suggests kind of the viewpoint of the old Star Trek series, where the ship is, it's a plot vehicle that gets you from one story to the other. stories don't really take place on the ship. They take place when the crew interact with wherever they are this week. HSD feels a little bit more like some of the modern series like Battlestar Galactica, where the story takes place on the ship. And this makes sense to me. While there are some colonized planets, the core seems to be kind of artificial habitats. So this feels to me like kind of a shipboard series, more kind of like, which is a Star Trek with the space station, Deep Space Nine. What are the other, some of the modern ones that take place a lot in ships? There's also The Expanse. What are some of the other modern sci-fi series?
There's that one where all the kids were buried in the 1950s underground. Spoilers.
Okay, that one. I mean, I like this because, I mean, again, ships, space stations aren't just
floating in the stars.
They aren't just kind of like gas stations on their way between cities. That they are places. I mean, if they're huge places, people live their entire life in a spaceship or on a space station. One of my favorite authors, C.J. Cherry, she covers this a lot, that she describes how shipboard culture gradually becomes almost a different wing of humanity with its own values. My reading, I mean, of course, with this background, I read HSD and I see this is a place to explore these artificial environments, but not just as a way to get to planet X where you'll have your actual adventures. No, your adventures will take place, some of them on terraformed planets, but a lot of them probably in ships or in space stations.
Well, I have to say that I kind of have a different opinion from both of those, in that I don't particularly see much of a limit to HSD. I don't really see it as much of a closed world. But at the same time, I also think that the sci-fi concept, the sci-fi genre itself, is very much the human story that's told on the different backdrop. You can take an entire role-playing game setting and place it in a town for a modern game. By expanding that setting out to space, I don't think that honestly changes the size of your background that much, because your lens is still going to be focused on a much smaller concept. It's going to be focused on the characters, the PCs, and what's going on immediately around them. You can run an entire sci-fi game and never leave a small space station, sure, or never leave a corp town. You potentially never even leave two blocks inside of a corp town. So I think the limitation that you are going to have is going to be the limitation of perspective. It's just, how big are you looking? And how big is the storyteller willing to expand out?
And at that point, the dragons become kind of the edge of your social space.
Very much so. The dragons might be the mob boss on one side and the predatory corporation on the other side. And if you don't have insight into either of those, it's very plausible to say that there are your dragons.
Marsco is sponsoring this episode and has asked you not to refer to them as predatory. Thank you.
Noted. I can feel my ledger gain lighter already.
Ding! To be fair, I mean, they have, there's Mars, there's Venus, there's a lot of places you can go. If you did want to do a kind of Star Trek style, what new and interesting place do we go to this week? Sure, you could definitely do that. To me, again, this is just me bringing my own perspective to it. It's interesting to approach it from a perspective of, how is this different from Dungeons and Dragons? How is this different from the point of light in the darkness fighting the monsters, instead of being people surrounded by people, and where there aren't races where you can say, look, you're a gnoll, you're evil because you're a gnoll, you're a goblin, I can kill you because you're evil. This is a world where that's not the case. There might be some people who are evil, but you can't just look at them and say, well, okay, apparently owls are an exception to this.
You can't really look at them, though.
Right, right. Oh, that's because, yes, because they're mysterious. So I think an exciting aspect to it is that it's a bit more civilized. And some of the fun of playing D&D or Shadowrun or in more hostile environments is that you can be a badass and kill stuff and not feel bad about it. And that's interesting, but I think it's also interesting to play a character that actually relates to modern morality and sensibilities a bit while still doing heroic things.
And with a finite universe, you can't really escape the party of merchants you killed on the far side of Jupiter.
another way to phrase that is there's no kobolds here. There's no kobolds, there's no zombies, there's no Nazis. There is no group of enemies that is just okay to kill. The monsters that do exist are generally either one-offs or they are way, way, way on the outside of reality and not something that anybody is going to be encountering very often in their life. It should be a once-in-a-lifetime type thing, unless you're really seriously going out and searching for them.
Yeah.
But if you're just a standard citizen, you're probably not going to see any of the monsters in HSD ever.
Unless they're on TV.
Unless they're on TV.
And also, a lot of the antagonists, they have cell phones too. The difference between the fantasy universe and the modern universe that we live in is huge and networked communication, where actions have consequences, which in a fantasy universe, you just leave town and whatever stupid thing your one character did, murdering the mayor over something trivial, won't follow you. But here, it does. And again, it's neat to play in the fantasy setting, but it's neat to play in a setting that's closer to real life, too.
So one of the frameworks of this game is the concept of, like, the contract mission, very much like Shadowrun used to model. If you go on a murder spree, chances are Marsco will deny any knowledge of your involvement in their company. You won't get another contract, and everybody you've dealt with that survived the experience is going to, you know, boat you down on LinkedIn or something like that. It's a very socially responsive universe.
Right. And again, I also like that because I can see how Shadowrun be a very fun setting, but I personally just cannot take it seriously. It's just too much. This is 14-year-old boy heaven, and I'm not a 14-year-old boy anymore. I just can't take it that seriously. Whereas in this setting, saying working for corporations, doing this stuff, well, I can take it a bit more seriously because it's not elves in black leather jackets and dragons with dark sunglasses.
And that sounds kind of like a good pause point for later. I think we've got some topics for other episodes down the road. So I'd like to kind of talk about tangentially related concepts to the world of furry sci-fi, science, technology, TRPGs, fuzzy animals. The table's open just for a moment.
I hear there's a surgery that makes lions suck less.
Wines, you never did specify your species.
I'm a hyena.
Okay.
Well, let's see. We can touch on that we are currently talking about and potentially within the next decade are looking for our first manned mission to Mars, and that is coming from a civilian corporation. Ooh. And not a government.
Oh, that is on topic.
Yeah, that hits pretty close to home.
Yeah.
We've had some medical breakthroughs in gene editing technology that brings that much more affordable and universal in the application, which kind of sets the next question into ethics and morals.
I think you're getting a little bit more global than what I was hoping for.
Well, one thing, you mentioned the trips to Mars, and they're making up lists of people interested in going to Mars, and they're telling people, as part of this, you know, it's going to be dangerous, and if you do this, you're going to die on Mars. And this kind of fits into some recent sci-fi, like The Martian. What was the one with the one where everything died off but corn?
I'll Google that.
I mean, so they had the robots, the slabs of things that rolled around. They're looking for a new home for humanity. There's several sci-fi movies in the recent past that are going in the direction of kind of explorers, man versus environment. No, not Wall-E. There's this cataclysm.
Right, the black hole. It was Singularity.
Singularity, is that what it's called?
Yeah, Singularity.
Okay, did you see it?
No.
Oh, good movie. Okay, let me start again. We've had kind of related to these topics of planetary exploration actually becoming practical and us realizing it's going to be a hard human task, not just one of sending out technology. We've had movies like Moon. We've had movies like, what was the one we just mentioned?
Singularity.
Movies like Singularity.
We might have mentioned it in a cut.
Movies like The Martian. which kind of go back to the 50s, where there was kind of a subgenre of sci-fi, which is man versus environment. More recently, Star Wars had kind of redefined sci-fi as telling human stories, as being more humans versus humans, or humans versus different kinds of humans. And so I think it's kind of interesting to get back in a more practical frame of conquering the solar system. And I think HSD kind of ties into that.
So there was an old Charlie Brown cartoon where Charlie Brown was sitting next to Linus looking at the clouds and seeing what they could see. And Linus said, "Oh, I see this, you know, transcendent vision of the goddess Liberty, something, 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 something." And Charlie Brown said, "I was going to say I see a ducky and a horsey, but I've changed my mind." So I want to talk about a really cute cat that I saw. It was called the Lycoy. It's a new breed from about 2009. They're somewhat furless cats that look like creepy werewolf cats with huge golden eyes and bear faces. Really very strange, and sort of a transition between cute and horrifying. Really adorable. They're going to be maybe recognized as an official cat breed in the vaguely near future by the International Cat Association. So that's my ducky and horsey.
And within 2 years, we should have one named Pookie.
In an ideal world. So I think we can just about call that an episode. So I guess thank y'all for listening, and catchy outro line. Intro music is Future Club and outro music is Chronicles, both by Serious Beat. This podcast is copyright 2016 by Radio Free Deimos and may be used in any not-for-profit project with appropriate credit and notification. Check out our website, radiofreedeimos.com, that's DEIMOS, for more rambling resources, links to official and Vanderbilt content, and our full catalog of episodes.